And the format of the evening is I'm going to introduce our guest speaker in a minute, Glenn Scrivener, who's from Australia, but has come all the way from Eastbourne to be with us today. And Glenn's been with us all week. He's been terrific, and we're really glad that he's been with us. He's going to be with us this evening, and he's going to be with us tomorrow morning at our services in the morning and in the evening as well. So you'll be very welcome to come back to those. And he'll be introducing and interviewing James Carey for us, who's our special guest this evening. James, a writer of many comedy sketches, and we're going to hear all about that, so I'll let them talk about it. But let's just warmly welcome them as they come up onto the stage here for this evening.
Very good. Thank you very much, Kev. And we are here tonight to enjoy James Carey. Your photo has
just
come
down.
Yeah,
it's gone. Hooray. The picture's gone.
At the start of the week, you were cycling through, so you were just 1/6 of the screen time. Now
bigger.
You are all the screen time.
Get bigger and bigger as the week goes on.
Because we've come to the end of the week.
Are you expecting someone else as well? I just think there's sort of two...
You've lost weight, James.
Well, yes, that's right. I have lost weight. I haven't lost that much weight. You didn't need to... Yes, I still resemble my photograph, I'm pleased to say.
Yes.
Yes, I was 4 stone heavier last year, but...
That's another.
That's a different intervention.
It's a different podcast. Yeah. You can earn lots of money. Yeah. So we had the picture and we had Life in Comedy.
Okay.
And you are sort of... I always feel for sort of comedians and comedy writers... Because the answer to the question, so you think you're funny, do you?
Yeah.
Is often, no.
Yeah, only Australians really think that. funny are you?
Funny
yeah.
are you?
Tell us a joke then. English people are much more polite. It's lovely to be here, by the way. Thank you.
I'm saddled with being Australian. You're saddled with being
Come
comedian.
On then, come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's but
get
you
away
are professionally so.
I know.
Do you feel the pressure in social situations?
Only like this. Not normally. I'm in my office most of the time screaming at a laptop and nobody sees that bit. But yeah, no, there is a bit of that. Although I tend to be funnier written down. And especially when then a famous person says it, it kind of works.
Yes.
But when it's just me, sorry, I'm trying to manage expectations here. Feels like I'm getting my
transcript of tonight.
I'm getting hilarious. Yes, that's right. I'm getting my excuses in early. If you want to heckle, then you need to write them down and send them forward, and I'll give you a written answer in about 3 weeks' time that will just wipe the floor with you. But. Yeah.
Can you remember, when did you decide that you were funny? When did you just discover?
I did what most people do when they sort of... So I've always loved comedy, and I just sort of didn't really see the point of anything else. Mm. So I just always wanted to watch it on TV. I'm the youngest of four, and so by the time I was 6 or older, my parents had given up enforcing TV time. So I just watched loads of television. It was great. Thanks, Mum. She doesn't need to feel ashamed of that, but I'm sure she does, but it was brilliant. So I just used to love watching comedy, and it's the reason why I can't stand dancing, because there used to be Royal Variety performances, and it would be brilliant because there would be comedians, and there didn't used to be that much stand-up comedy on television when I was growing up in the 80s and early 90s. And but then it's like, oh, it's a comedian, and it's like, oh, and then they introduce somebody, and it's a dancer, and it's like, oh, I've got to go to bed in 10 minutes, and it's a dancer. You know, I hope the comedian comes on before long. So I disproportionately don't like dancing, which is why I was thrilled when my daughter gave up ballet. That was brilliant.
And started up stand-up.
Because it just has this kind of reaction to me. It's the same reason I have the same reaction, incidentally, for horse racing.
Horse racing, in the middle of the cricket.
Yeah, yeah. So we used to watch cricket over here, and then they used to interrupt it for the horse racing. And then my impression of horse racing is, this is the opposite of cricket.
The shipping news makes
exactly. Yeah.
Blood boil.
So I don't know how we got onto that. I've always loved comedy growing up, and my parents are dairy farmers. I didn't know anybody who worked in comedy. In the 80s and 90s, I mean, who wanted to be a writer? That wasn't a thing. Mm. Now everyone wants to be a writer. But back then, I just enjoyed doing comedy. So I used to write little comedy sketches at school.
Can you remember any of your early...
Well, I think most people... I don't know whether I did one of these, but if you're 43 or older, which I am, the first sketch you wrote will have been a parody of Blind Date. Yes. And that question for number one, you know, we can all, there was that kind of framework, and that's kind of, everyone starts out in parody, and now, you know, in 20 years' time, people will say, oh, I remember writing my first X Factor sketch,
yes,
you know, or whatever it is. But you always start off sort of writing sketches and parodying the stuff off the TV. Mm-hmm. So I must have done stuff like that at some point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just, at school, there was opportunities to do little bits and pieces here and there, and it was a fairly supportive environment. It's only recently I've realised quite how lucky I was that the school I went to wasn't an absolute bear pit, and actually I felt fairly comfortable like writing things and trying things and doing things and being indulged. But and the other thing is also when you're young, you just end up quoting comedy as well, and obviously I did that. I didn't understand most of it,
no.
But that doesn't stop you. And people, and then if you're a child, you say stuff and adults laugh, and they're laughing at the fact that you're saying something that you don't understand. But you love the laugh so much, you just say it again, or you just sort of, oh, I must memorize more of that Two Ronnies sketch that I don't understand. But of course, you would have, your memory had to be really good back then, because we got a video recorder when I was 11,
yes,
maybe. And that's why I know Victoria Wood. An audience with Victoria Wood, I've memorized that.
Wow.
Because that's one of the first things I taped off the TV.
Yes.
And I watched, I must have seen it 40, 50 times.
So it's the case of if you listen to enough guitar music, at some stage you're going to pick up a guitar. If you watch enough comedy.
To some extent. You do sort of see what works and what doesn't, and you do see what you like and what you don't like. And you do, you know, and there's loads of comedy you just think, that's amazing, I could never do that. But it certainly helps. You know, it's kind of a bit odd if you don't know any comedy at all to sort of think that you'd be able to do it.
Yeah.
But some, I'm sure some people will, you know, break that rule.
So we're going to think about comedy and faith and how those things can kind of come together. Was your family a kind of a church-going family? Was faith a part of the growing up?
Not really a church-going family. We sort of went to church a bit, and the church in the village was not particularly inspiring. Certainly in my, when I was quite young, it turned into a decent church, actually, by the time I'd sort of, I'd left the village. I don't know if there's any link. But we would sort of go at Easter and occasionally when there was sort of some guilt circling around the house. But other than that, we didn't go very much. But my parents did make an unusual decision to send me to a extremely Christian school. So actually I kind of caught a Christian faith, as it were, through the school rather than through my parents reading the Bible with me or praying with me or anything like that. They didn't do any of those things at all. It was through going to a Christian school that I sort of thought, oh, this Christianity seems to be quite important. I should probably have a think about that. Yeah,
interesting analogy to say you caught it. It was in the air. It was something that you got in proximity to it, and it infected you.
It infected me. Okay. And it was plausible, it was credible, it was well presented, and it was clearly, and I kind of spotted even from the, I was a weird kid, let's just get that out of the way, but I spotted age 8 or 9 that the Christianity being presented and the way in which various Christian members of staff lived was slightly different from the way the rest of the world was and the way the rest of the world lived. And as I got a little bit older, I realized that actually there are two worlds going on here. And at some point, I'm going to have to make a bit of a decision, if you think that's a thing. So I kind of worked out. By the time I was like 10 or 11, I just thought, this is not a great testimony story, by the way.
Where are the car chases?
Yeah, exactly. No car chases.
And then you're a male model.
Yes,
then,
exactly. Yeah. You know. Oh, wow. Don't even try and think about that. I think I realized that there was an unseen world, an unseen realm that I really needed to engage with and think about and actually make some kind of commitment to. And I didn't quite understand the links. And then I do remember specifically asking a question. I think there was like a Q&A thing where anybody could just write a question and put it in a box. Mm-hmm. And I remember a school chapel service where they said, and, you know, the question from the box is, which is my question is, I don't understand how Jesus dying on the cross helps me. Mm. It seems really important. Mm. And there are kind of like crosses everywhere, but I, you know, but I don't get it.
Great question.
And it was actually the headmaster, I think, explaining that Jesus goes to the cross because the way I live, my natural inclination is to do things that are away from God, and that the wages of sin, as the Bible says, Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death, and so that is my natural state. And actually what happens is Jesus takes my place on the cross. He dies so that I can live. And I thought, oh, okay, so it's kind of a bit of a swap. Mm-hmm. I can see that kind of a load of other things, I think, just kind of went clunk into place. And I thought, oh, okay. Oh, I guess I'm a Christian then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Bad luck.
And I guess it kind of went, yes, dramatic. I said I was a weird kid. And I think as I got older, you ask better and better questions. Uh-huh. And I remember when I was about 15, I read a book called The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, which is the kind of which essentially became the Da Vinci Code. That was the non-fiction book on which the Da Vinci Code was based, and the idea that Jesus had an illegitimate son or was married to somebody. And I remember thinking, if I study theology at university, this probably will come up if there's anything to it at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of didn't because it's nonsense.
Yes.
And so I did theology at university, and it kind of like, there were no kind of like, oh, I've seen the catch now, I get it, it's all wrong.
Yeah.
It was just like, yeah, that kind of checks out. Oh, that kind of seems right. Okay, that's, and it just, I was just kind of building on it really.
Because there are two things that people often say when you become a Christian. They expect that somehow your personality will be removed and somehow your brain...
Oh, no, I kept the personality. Sorry about that. Yes, that's right. My friends were very disappointed. Yeah.
And then they take away your brain. So you become kind of soulless and brainless in order to be a Christian. But I guess as you went to Durham and you studied theology...
I'm not that bright. I went to Durham. Yeah.
And at Durham, I guess you're kind of testing out both those hypotheses because you're studying theology academically and you're thinking, okay, this stuff holds water.
Yeah.
And also you're getting on with the comedy writing thing.
Yeah, I spent most of my time doing that, in fact. The theology department is right next door to a 1,000-year-old massive cathedral. Mm. And you just think, well, that's, you know, Christianity has stood the test of time and there's, you know, there seems to be something in it. So that's kind of reassuring when something 1,000 years old is kind of next to you and it doesn't look like it's going anywhere. I spent a lot of time doing... And the reason I wanted... Obviously, I went to Durham because obviously I applied to Cambridge. And I didn't get in. I didn't get in not once, but twice.
Oh, really?
No. Because I wanted to go to Cambridge because that's where all the comedians come from.
Yes.
Footlights and all that kind of stuff. So I thought that would be good to go there. And there was a divergence of opinion on my suitability for a place at Trinity College, Cambridge. I lost. So I went to Durham and ended up doing lots of comedy. If I'd been at I might have been put off comedy if I'd gone. So it might be God's grace that I didn't go there because the likes of sort of Mitchell and Webb were floating around. Mm. And they're really funny. And I might have just thought, oh, crikey, they're good. Mm-hmm. I'm not that good.
You might have been on the bench.
Yeah, I might have been. So things might have been different. But or either that, or I might just be much more well-connected and much more successful and far too busy to do stuff like this.
We're glad you were rejected.
Yeah, well, yes, that's right. Yeah, yes, that's right. So everybody wins.
Yeah. 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 And so you're starting to write comedy and you were going to Edinburgh and that sort of thing?
Edinburgh Festival, we were doing shows. Yeah, so as a result of, you know, Durham was not as competitive, so I started organising Edinburgh shows. I did the Edinburgh Fringe in 96 and 97 and then left university and then went back with three of us in 1999 and we got nominated for a comedy award, which is very nice. At that point, I wrote a sitcom script as well, which Radio 4 were kind of interested in, so... Quite quickly, I was writing a sitcom for Radio 4 called Think the Unthinkable about management consultants, which is what lots of my friends at university were doing. I kind of spotted that, you know, I was age 23, 24, just thinking, so my friends I was at university with are working for companies like Anderson Consulting and are telling people twice their age how to run their business.
Mm.
That seems pretty funny. that feels like a show. And so I did that, and people seem to like that. And doing sketches and that kind of stuff. And then I went from there. The guy who kind of mentored me in doing that is a lovely man called Paul Mayhew Archer, who co-wrote at least half the episodes of The Vicar of Dibley. He was very kind to me. He got me involved in writing a show on BBC One called My Hero with Ardlo Hanlon. That's good fun to do. I wrote an episode of My Family. Mm-hmm. My claim to fame on My Family is I watched the episode that had the lowest ratings of, I think, virtually any episode of My Family.
Okay.
And that's because they broadcast it on the same night as the last ever episode of Friends.
Ah, wow.
Literally up against it. You know what I mean? We only got 4 million viewers, you know, it's like, which was bad back then. Now you go, 4 million is great. Yeah. And it had Peter Capaldi in it before he was famous.
Wow.
He was always a little bit famous, but before he became Thick of It and Doctor Who and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, sort of shuttled around between doing TV and radio and stuff, and it kind of turned out that I got away with not being a dairy farmer and being a comedy writer.
Phew.
Yeah.
Milking, yeah. Milking this morning.
I remember I sort of said to me, I'm the first non-dairy farming Carey, I think, since the Norman Conquest, from what I can tell.
Did your parents take that well when you said, when you broke it to them?
It's a bit of a mixed bag, really, because on one level, they're relieved, because dairy farming is a terrible business to be in now, because for a whole variety of reasons. So I did say to them, I don't want to be a dairy farmer, because it's a really uncertain and difficult life. And they were like, oh, phew. I said, I'm going to be a writer. And they were like, so it did feel a bit like a frying pan fire situation, but I kind of got away with it for long enough, and then at some point they started to believe that I could actually do it.
Yeah, so My Family getting its lowest ratings ever was sort of a low light.
Yeah.
What are some of the highlights of the James Carey
comedy career? Well, writing an episode that's actually on TV is a bit of a highlight, the upsides then go, I guess. So then did a show on Radio 4 again called Hut 33 about codebreakers in World War II. This is before it was cool and The Imitation Game and stuff. Hmm. So missed another zeitgeist there. and then I ended up working on the radio version of Miranda Hart's show, which had, I think, already been commissioned for TV at the time. So I then ended up working on the TV show. So I worked on the first two series of that. And obviously that was exciting to work on that, because that was deemed to be a success, although at the time it did not seem in any way inevitable. Mm. And I can obviously still remember all of the negative reviews when it first came out.
Okay. You know their names and addresses.
Yeah, Caitlin Moran in the Times began her review with the words, "Oh dear." I don't remember what it said after that, but you know, you only remember the bad reviews. Which is why I can remember A.A. Gill's two pages in the culture section of the Sunday Times for the show I did afterwards called Bluestone 4-2, and said that everybody involved in that show should be paraded through Wooden Bassett in shame.
He's not a comedy fan in general.
No,
though,
and he's dead now, but I had nothing to do with that. TV critics are a bit of a bête noire, really, of the comedy industry. Mm. And A.A. Gill is on record as saying he really liked the sitcom Lead Balloon, because he said, Lead Balloon's brilliant because it's the sort of comedy you can enjoy which doesn't make you laugh out loud, because laughing is vulgar. And you go, wow, this is a guy who I don't want to impress.
Yes.
And so, actually, if I'd got a good review for this Bluestone 4-2 show, I probably would have actually been more worried. But you only remember the negatives. But yeah, but Miranda was probably a bit of a hit, and it was fun, right? I wrote the Christmas episode for the second series, which had a scene which I still love, where Christmas is going really badly, and Miranda and Stevie go into a cupboard and just say it's going really badly, and they're sort of whispering, and then somebody else comes in, they say, oh, it's going really badly, isn't it, but don't tell. And then somebody else comes in, they whisper, and then somebody else, and it's like they're all in the closet, and they're all whispering, and then they realise that everybody is now in the closet and they don't need to whisper anymore. I do remember thinking, oh, I think that will be funny. And you kind of little moments like that. I enjoy doing the hotel episode. I came up with that idea. I mean, in theory, Miranda came up with the idea, because we were sitting in the room and and basically every funny idea Miranda had ever had in her life was up on post-it notes on the walls. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, and it was the first series, it's like, we need to make 3 hours of television, help me! Mm-hmm. And so we sort of started, oh, what's this and what's this, and sort of putting together, me and this other chap called Richard. And then I noticed one that said, Miranda in a hotel. And I said to Miranda, what's that? Mm-hmm. Miranda in a hotel, what's mm-hmm. that idea? Mm-hmm. And she just said, oh, I just think me being in a hotel would be funny. And I was like, okay, it's a start. And then I sort of, you know, we packed up for the day, and then overnight I came, and I sort of, the next day I came in with the idea of, how about Miranda books one of those secret hotel things, and it turns out that the hotel is actually in her hometown.
Yeah.
And she's told everyone she's going on holiday, and now she has to hide in this hotel, because if it looks like she's going on, you know, it just looks awful.
Yeah.
And as I was pitching it to her, I said, so we'll do that, and then this, and then you can do all the hotel material that you've got. Uh-huh. And she said, I don't have any hotel material. I was like, I just assumed you had a ton of jokes about it because it's the same random. She said, no, I just think it would be funny, me being in a hotel. And then to be fair to her, we sort of did the outline and all that kind of stuff and plotted it. And then Miranda wrote the first draft, and she just had all this really funny stuff in about how brilliant it is being in a hotel room, and that you have a kettle in your bedroom, and that you would never normally have a kettle in your bedroom. You sort of get out and turn it on with one smooth movement and all that kind of stuff. And that was all her, you know, kind of. So it was a fun kind of collaboration of, like, you know, Richard and I helped with the framework of it, and then she would just sort of do all that lovely Miranda stuff.
Can I ask a question that's horrible to ask?
Go on.
Because what reminds me is, we all just laugh at the idea of, isn't it funny to have a kettle in the bedroom?
Yeah.
Why on earth is that funny?
No idea. And if any of you know why that's funny, please can you tell me?
What's the algorithm? And then
I don't know. I think that's kind of observational comedy, isn't it? I think that is, there is a pleasure in observing something that you thought you'd noticed, but then it turns out that somebody else has noticed it as well. Mm-hmm. And the comedian kind of notices this about 6 months before everybody else notices it.
Yes.
You know, the great... You know, I'm a big Michael McIntyre fan. I think he's really funny. I know lots of people find him tiresome or annoying, but I think he's really funny. And the idea that a man has a drawer with all of his stuff, you know, like keys to sheds that he hasn't owned for a decade and all that kind of stuff. And you just go, yes, I thought it was just me who was such a shambles that I had that drawer, but everyone has that drawer. And so there is a sort of a cathartic laugh there and recognition or...
Recognition? Is that part of laughter? I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. I should know. I've literally written a book on how comedy works.
Here we go.
So I should know.
The sacred art of joking.
So in the first half... you put it down now. I was going to bring up a book and wave it. And I just thought, don't do that. That's just pathetic. Because you can get it afterwards, but I'm not going to mention it again. Mm-hmm. But no, in the first third of the book, I try to explain how jokes work. And there are lots of... And I don't believe that there is a grand unified theory of comedy, because the moment you think, this explains all jokes, someone will just go, oh, what about knock-knock jokes? Mm-hmm. Yes, no, that doesn't fit, you know, and you just sort of, you kind of have this kind of paradigm. And I think there's a big thing. And so the other thing is, jokes, academic jokes about comedy are the least funny things in the world.
Sure.
You know, they hurt to read. And actually some theologians have written books about comedy as well, and they're mainly German and Danish, who are not known for their sense of humor. So a German theologian writing about comedy, that is not a promising beginning. But actually they came up with a pretty good idea, really, that comedy is two things that don't belong next to each other.
Right.
So you think it's going to be this and it's that, or that with that, which is why you have, you know, little and large, and you know, you have big and small, and you have you know, sort of double acts like that.
Yes.
And you think the joke's going to be this and it's actually that, and you think it's going to be this, it's going to be that. And
a horse wearing a hat.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you kind know. Of.
Yeah. I'm sure. With a flower in it. Yeah.
Yes, that's crazy. Right. That, in some situation, that would be funny. but just not now, apparently.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm particularly interested in that and I felt I had to explain it is because I then go on to explain how jokes go horribly wrong. And we've all told jokes, as we are doing this evening, telling jokes which apparently don't go for anything, but also how they can kind of get you fired and killed, because now jokes have sort of been sort of weaponized and everyone's sort of seizing on jokes and jumping on jokes as a reason to demand that you never work again or are you deleted from existence or whatever it is. And that's a real shame. And Christians are actually pretty bad for this as well. And we do like getting offended. Mm. And often actually Christians, the worst thing about Christians, and I can say this because I am one, is people say, well, I wasn't offended, but I just worry that others might have been. And you go, okay, so it was fine, but you think it might not be. Thanks for your feedback. You know, what am I meant to do with that? So I think it would be great if, given how bitterly divided our society is at the moment, and it is exhausting, isn't it? And I was just reflecting today on how, you know, this sort of vortex of politics and media, you know, wherever you stand on the debate, is exhausting and upsetting. And it did put me in mind of a joke I heard in, I think it was in 1994, and they were talking about the Channel Tunnel had just been opened, or was about to be opened, and they had this big celebratory dinner to celebrate the £80 billion spent on this tunnel under the thing. And there was a dinner halfway through which contained all the politicians and all the journalists from England and France. And the joke was basically, now, if you just sealed it up at both ends, that would be great value for money, wouldn't it? Like, wow, they're in there. We've got them. Okay. You know, nobody used the Channel Tunnel. And it does kind of feel like that. So if you could all just go somewhere else and the rest of us can just get on with everything, that would be great. But wouldn't it be brilliant if churches and Christians could be the ones who actually reconcile people and are full of joy? Mm. But actually, comedians, Christians are often quite nervous about comedy, and churches aren't known for their sense of humour. They may be, there were statistics done recently in lots of research about people actually thought that Christians tended to be friendly and were actually warm, and you know the statistics are quite good for Christians. You know, funny was not on the list.
No.
So I think that's, you know, there's a load of reasons why I think that is, which I go into in the book in forensic detail, but you don't.
And the book, The Sacred Art of Joking, available at the back.
Yeah. This is not for that. I just thought it's annoying if you think you want to buy it and then you can't. That just seems perverse. So that's the only reason I brought some copies.
Okay. So you can. So fantastic. Yeah. So help us with that. Help us put together Christianity and comedy, because we've got these John's Gospels, for instance.
Yeah.
So this is a part of the Bible, one of the 66 books in the library that we call the Bible.
Yeah.
This isn't funny, is it?
It is quite funny, but there's a problem here. Okay. It's because there's a variety of reasons. If you're a Christian, you already know the stories, and you're never going to find it funny. And you have had it read publicly so badly for your whole life that it's about as funny as Shakespeare appears to be when you act it badly. But actually, Shakespeare done well, the comedies are really funny. But the church does not any longer have a tradition of doing the Bible well, which is weird. Even really, pro-Bible churches like this one, brilliant. It's great, but actually we spend a lot of time on music and lots of other things, and then we kind of read the Bible out loud and we preach it, and that's all great. But actually it's weird how we sort of read it and, yeah, okay, we get the gist, but it would be like reading out a Shakespeare play, unrehearsed, sight reading it, and then having a lecture on it.
Yes.
You wouldn't do that with Shakespeare.
No.
And also, when you go into a church, you're not expecting to laugh. You're not expecting, it's not known for being a fun place. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine, Paul Carenza, does comedy gigs often in churches. And he has to spend the first 5 or 10 minutes reassuring the audience in a church that it's okay to laugh. They can laugh. It's fine. it's not a low-ceilinged comedy club, but it's okay. We can get over it. Buildings, my church was, they finished building it in about 1380, and you're not expecting that to be a hilarious place with a very high ceiling. It's not really set up for it. And also, Jesus in art is always portrayed as serious. He always has a bit of a 1,000-yard stare.
Yeah. Yeah.
Um, the Jesus of Nazareth with Robert Powell, of course. My mum always just says, whenever she used to see him on television subsequently, like when he was in that show with Jasper Carrot, do you remember, the detectives? She would always say, without fail, there's always something that your parents say at the TV, no matter, you know, and they forget that they say it every time.
But they can't not say
They can't not say it. I mean, the most common one is, he's dead now, you know, which is like, you know, like with Dad's Army, dead. Yeah, we know. You know, and we know that Clive Dunn is still alive, and it's amazing, you know, whatever. But for my mum, it was always, she'd watch the detectives with Jasper Carrot and Robert Powell, and she'd always say, well, this is a bit of a come down after playing Jesus Christ. which on one level is probably true. But the idea is that Jesus can't be funny. He isn't funny. And actually, I think that's just not true. I'm not arguing that Jesus was a stand-up comedian. You know, I'm not one of these people who just says, you know, my thing is Jesus's thing, and that's. And I did an interview publicised in the book with Edward Sturton on the Sunday programme on Radio 4, and he did not buy my hypothesis that Jesus was funny.
Okay,
he is a very serious-minded man. but my contention is that the events of the Gospels are surprising. I mean, not only is Jesus God as man, he's basically a superhero. And superheroes used to be funny, and now they're kind of boring and po-faced and grown up. But I can still remember watching the first Superman film when it was on TV in about 1983 or something, and Superman catches Lois Lane falling from a building, and like catches her, and he says, "It's okay, I've got you." And she says, "You've got me." Who's got you? Because he's like, she's never seen a superhero before. They are surprising. Now, if you go and if you take that view in John's Gospel, John's Gospel alone, it'd be like, okay, so when Jesus changes water into wine, they're not expecting him to do that because they haven't read John's Gospel. They don't know it's coming. So, I mean, it's already funny at the start when. There was a wedding. They run out of wine. Very embarrassing. And then the mum goes to Jesus and just says, you know, he might know what to do. Can you sort him out with some wine? And he says, woman, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come. But it's basically, no. and then she says, do whatever he tells you. He's just like. I've literally just said I'm not going to help. and my Jewish mother has basically just says, oh, he'll sort it out for you. It's just like, unbelievable. But then can you imagine, again, not knowing what's going to happen. So what happens in the story, I mean, this is, you know, you might know this story because it's quite a well-known one and it gets read out at weddings. Our Lord himself was a guest at a wedding, you would have heard that and said. And so Jesus turns water into wine. But again, they fill this water, these huge jars with water. And then it says nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding 80 to 120 litres. Jesus says, fill the jars with water. So they fill them to the brim. And they're thinking, he knows this isn't wine, right? I mean, as I say, they both begin with W. They don't in the Greek. That joke doesn't work. But and then he says, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. And he's like going, okay. He does know this isn't wine, doesn't he? And also, okay, it's first century Middle East. Okay, don't drink the water. It's poisonous. That's why you drink wine. And so he's thinking, I might be poisoning my boss now. This is not how I thought today would turn out, you know. And so he's sort of going, here you go, you know. And he tastes it. And he's just like thinking, well, I'm dead now. You know, he's going to kill me or something. It's a bad day. And he just said, this is the most amazing wine. You've saved the best till last. And so that's kind of a bit of a funny moment. The bit that's, and then the master sort of says to the steward, this is incredible. You've gathered, you know, you've saved the best wine till last. Mm. And what we don't get, and in John you get quite a lot of bits where you don't see what happens next. And yeah. I am reading more into it than I probably should, but it still makes me laugh, the idea that the master says to the bridegroom, you've saved the best till last. What does the bridegroom make of it? They've run out of wine. Why do you think that is? And what sort of condition do you think the bridegroom is in? You know what I mean? Yeah, They've run out of wine.
Yeah.
You saved the best till last.
Yeah.
Yeah! I did! It's just like you have no idea what.
Like the superabundance is definitely a theme.
Yeah.
We're talking like 600 bottles of wine.
Yeah, it's like. Jesus. Yeah, it's
600.
Like. 600. 600 bottles. So like those comically large bottles.
Yeah.
It's like 30 of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've already drunk it all.
And they've already drunk all of the wine. And it's like, it is a comic abundance. You get loads of these kind of amazing things. But we forget, oh yeah, Jesus turns water into wine. It's like, it's incredible. They're not expecting it.
Yeah.
Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is another amazing story. And again, we know that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. So there's nothing funny about it.
Hmm.
But I love the idea. This is not original to me or my observation. But the idea that Jesus, so Lazarus is in the tomb. He's been bound up. One of my favorite verses in the Bible is in the King James Version. So this is an English joke, not a Bible joke, where Jesus says, take away the stone. And in the King James says, Mary or Martha says to Jesus, he hath been in the tomb for 4 days and he stinketh, I love that. He stinketh. But also, even in English, that's kind of funny, where Jesus basically says, roll away the stone.
Yeah.
And someone just says, it's going to smell really bad. It's just like, you've literally just ruined the moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
thanks. Yeah. And then he says, Lazarus, come out. And I love the idea that he kind of needs to say Lazarus, because if he didn't specify Lazarus, then every single dead body in all the tombs, there would have been this like zombie apocalypse coming.
Yeah.
And of course, Lazarus is literally tightly bound like this. He can't move.
Yeah.
So there would have been a bit of an awkward pause.
Yeah.
He's just like, coming.
Like,
sort of undignified hopping on his back. But then the thing that's really, the real kicker for me, though, is how amazing story. And then there were people there. They go back to the temple and they're kind of really angry. And they tell them what they've done. And they just go, He's raised him from the dead. They don't doubt it for a second. They believe that he raised someone from the dead. But their reaction is sort of like, well, we can't let him go on doing this, because then everyone will believe in him. You're just like thinking, can you not hear what you're saying? And then they come up with the most amazing plan. It's basically, they decide, and at that moment, it says in John chapter 11, it says, and at that moment, they decided to put him to death. And you go, so what we're basically saying is, this guy has power over life and death.
Mm.
Let's kill him. And you go, I don't try.
It's a theory. Try it out.
I don't think he'll stay dead. but it's really weird, because the other thing that's weird is the fact that the Pharisees and the temple priests and stuff, they assume they can kill Jesus.
Yeah.
And they just said, well, we're going to have to kill him. And you just think, you idiots, you obviously can't kill him, he's God.
Yeah.
But the disciples assume that Jesus cannot be killed. Mm. Because then when Jesus says to them, I'm going to be arrested and tried and killed, and I will rise again on the third day. And they will go, he's going to be arrested and killed. What could he mean? And you're like,
yeah. They're always doing
that. And literally, you can imagine, like, I literally don't know how to make it clearer than that. I have, and then when he is being crucified, they're just like, we didn't see this coming. So, three times.
Yeah.
And then when he comes back from the dead, they're not expecting it as well. It's like,
It's
amazing.
Yeah.
And yet, it's like, well, we can obviously kill him, and they can't. And, well, he obviously can't die. Well, he can, you know. There are so many of these kind of comic reversals all over that if you're open to them, then they are there. I'm not saying all of the Bible's funny and all that kind of stuff, but if you have eyes to see and ears to hear, as it were, and you do put a bit of work into actually just reading it out loud then it is surprising that is the first thing you notice whenever you do hear the Bible read well, mm-hmm. is how funny it is. Yeah. And I've seen audiences watch, you know, entire Gospels being performed. And for the first 5 minutes, they don't laugh because they don't think they're allowed to. Mm. But then there are so many repetitions. Mm-hmm. You know, in the one of the other Gospels where the angel keeps saying, "Fear not." Like, and again, if you only have one reading of a few verses in a service, you won't get that. But then by the time the third time the angel talks to somebody and he says, "Fear not." It's just like, hey, you know, I have to keep telling people this. Yeah. This is, so there's like repetition there that you really get when you do long bits of it. But so that's why the Bible, I think, is, and I think therefore Christians can be much more joyful and enjoy comedy more because it's in the Bible. The Bible is comic. Mm. And it's also troubling in other ways, and there are very odd things happening, and lots of it is, you know, is stuff that if it wasn't in the Bible, we would say, well, that's disgusting, you can't do that, or anything like that. So I think we need to be a bit more grown up, and sometimes it feels like what we don't want to be is sort of holier than Jesus, because the way Jesus talks as well, he is very mean to people sometimes. He says very sharp things, and they are offended by them, and he has intended that offense. Mm-hmm. And he is fine with that. And you can imagine that if Jesus maybe were preaching in our sort of context, people might be coming up to him afterwards and just saying, I mean, I wasn't offended, but I just worry that others might have been. It's just a question of tone. I think people might mishear.
They do actually do that to Jesus. Do you realize that some of the teachers of the law might have been offended by that?
Yeah, it's just like,
kind of the point.
And, you know, and Jesus talks about, you know, there's one bit where they come away from this thing. He's talking about killing himself. What is he talking about?
Yeah.
And Jesus is fine for them to misunderstand, whereas we just assume that the greatest enemy is doubt, that everyone knows exactly what, and actually it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah. So lots of examples of comedy here.
Yeah. I think about this stuff a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see the energy come out of him?
Yeah.
So the cutting words, the ridiculousness of people, and that comic reversals thing.
Yeah.
The Bible is just full of you expect death and you get life.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. That's a joyous sort of comedic thing. So
and the idea that God, idea that God can become man.
Right.
Is so patently absurd that Islam rejects Christianity almost entirely on that basis. If you say, well, you know, Jesus is, and he is a prophet of them, but when we say, well, he was God, they will go, can't be.
Because it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. It is silly to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's obviously silly to lots of atheists as well and secular people. It's hardwired in. Sorry, I interrupted you there, but that's a bit that I think people often miss.
But it's wonderful.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay. You were about to say something intelligent then, and I ruined it. Sorry.
Fat chance of that.
Yeah.
So.
Sorry, I agreed too quickly with that.
Too loudly. Yeah. So, okay. So the Bible is comedic, and we're going to think about that in a second. But you said a little bit about Christianity. It doesn't mean it costs you your personality. It doesn't mean it costs you your sense of humor. It doesn't mean it costs you your brain.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about Jesus that compels you, that makes you think, he's my Lord, he's mine, he's worth following in life?
Yeah. Oh, man, that's hard. So, I mean, we already talked about how, in a way, he's kind of done everything I need to be reconciled with God, and he kind of makes sense of the universe, but actually, it's really weird, and it's kind of magic how you read the Bible, and Jesus's words and parables are just endlessly fascinating, and you read parables and you just think this is an extraordinary story, and then you think you understand it, and then 5 years later you read it again, and you just think, I have no idea what this parable means. I'm going to have to think about it again. And, I think it means the opposite of what I thought it meant. And, I think I might have preached a sermon saying that it said the other thing. I should probably phone everybody and tell them. And yet, it kind of does mean that. And also, it is astonishing. And the more you read, and I just really recommend, you know, there are loads of arguments, and I could, you know, we could talk about Jesus and the concept of Christ, and there are loads of things that can be said, which are fine. But actually, what you need to do is you just need to read him, read what he says. If you've never actually read what he says for yourself, you will not regret spending an hour, which is how long it will take you, to read this. And if you can do it open-heartedly and say to God, look, I don't really understand all this, but can you help me understand it? I know that you might not want to do that because you might be frightened of the results. But what have you, I'm not a fan of Pascal's wager, but what have you got to lose? But I just think and as you read the Bible more and more, and as I discovered in my theology degree and also just being a Christian for, a few decades, is that you just see how Jesus kind of fulfills so many things in the Old Testament and how it all kind of fits together. And there are all these stories that appear random at first and that they just kind of fit together into this overarching story, which kind of makes sense of everything, not just my life and everything, everything around me, but just of history and where we come from and where we're going. I just find the overall package compelling in that way. But it isn't just an idea, it's a person. And that's why I urge you. And that's why these Twitter debates and Facebook debates and stuff, they're all fine and they might be fun if you like that kind of thing. But actually, the Christian faith is not a series of arguments. And it's not even a bunch of decent jokes. That's not it either. It's a person. And it's a person who made you, who knows you, who loves you. And actually, it's probably, ask me 10 years ago or 12 years ago and I would have said something different, but I have a daughter who's 11 now and another one who's 9. And the way I relate to God now is different because of them, because, I now can see in them how God must see me because he made me. I was there. I didn't make them, as it were, but you just sort of see how, you just see how that love kind of operates between you and someone you can relate to. And I just think that's another kind of paradigm. Just all of these relationships are start to fall into place. And yet, 5 years later, you just think, oh, I hadn't realized that. And then you just keep going and going. It's a bit like the C.S. Lewis sort of approach where, even in eternity at the very end, they just keep going further on and further up. They just keep finding new levels and new truth. And sorry, that won't mean anything to you if you've not read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe books. But
but the way in, pick up.
Pick it up. Read. And just read it. It won't take you long. Mm. And I think you'll find that Jesus says things that you hadn't really expected. Mm. And I think if you do have an open mind, you will be surprised. Mm. Surprises are often funny. Shocks are often not funny. That's another reason why jokes go wrong. Boring. There's a chapter on that. So I just think because he is a person, he's not an idea, and he knows me, and therefore, it doesn't. Being a Christian hasn't cost me my brain or cost me all this thing. It also hasn't cost me my job, because my identity is not in my job. My identity is in Christ, because he is personal rather than, because fun fact, it's really hard to make a living as a writer. And a new sort of thing that, it's 10% of all people, of all published authors or writers, that's their only source of income. That's a very unusual thing. And I realize how lucky I am to be quite good at something that pays enough to be able to, not have to do anything else. But therefore, you can easily become bound up in, I'm a writer. And we've all got those things where we want to be, it could be I'm a mum, or it could be I'm a partner now, I'm a partner of the firm, or I'm captain of the team, or, we all have these things that we chase after. And it's so easy to put our identity into those things. But actually the difference of being a Christian means that, I remember I did a radio show which don't went down quite well, and we tried to offer it to TV to be a sitcom and for the TV show, and it would have been a huge break for me at the time. And I prayed before we had this big artificial read-through in front of the head of BBC One, and it's every bit as funny as that sounds. And I did pray before that. I prayed to God, this would be amazing if it came through, and but I don't know if this is the right thing for me. So if it's not right for me, then take it away. And the read-through went fine, and then 3 weeks later they just said, they didn't really want to go with your show. And, you know, that could have been totally crushing. Mm. And in actual fact, it was only very disappointing. Because my self-worth is not bound up in my identity as a writer. My self-worth is bound up in Christ's worth, in his... I'm made in his image. He died for me. I am loved by him. All of those things are just the ways in which I think, even though, obviously, I love being a writer, and it's wonderful to have your weirdly large face on a large screen because you wrote some jokes for someone who was tall and female and knows how to fall over. But actually, knowing Christ is by far the greatest thing.
It's the main thing. A lot of wisdom there. Time has absolutely flown. But will you stick around?
Yeah, I'm around afterwards if you want to chat about anything or anything.
Fantastic.
Like that. I've got to drive back to Yeovil in Somerset.
Yes.
Which is where I actually live. So I won't be here for hours and hours. But,
yeah.
But do come and say hello, and I would happily chat to you.
Brilliant. James Carey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
And do you want to pick up one of your John's Gospels here? It's not a joke book, but it is comedic, okay? And we're going to have a look at the very ending of John's Gospel. And in a few minutes, I just want to take you through ways in which this book is comedic, okay? This book is absolutely comedic. And we're going to turn to page 52. And on page 52, we're going to see examples of all the kinds of comedy that we just mentioned. We're going to hear cutting words, we're going to see the ridiculousness of people, and we're going to see a surprising reversal on page 52, Jesus and the miraculous catch of fish. But as we turn there, let me just give you the difference between tragedy and comedy. Do you know what the difference is between tragedy and comedy? Dante, the old poet, who was the author of the Divine Comedy, he ought to know. He said, a tragedy is a story that begins in joy and ends in pain. Okay, so it's shaped like a frowny face. Okay, so you go up, you enjoy your brief moment in the sun, and then you tumble down into the miserable ever after. Okay, that is a tragedy. But Dante said, a comedy is a story that begins in pain but ends in joy. So turn that frown upside down. Here we go. We've got a smile. And you go down into the pit, and there's all sorts of peril and danger and struggle, and you snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, and you end on a high. Smiley face. That's the comedy. Think of Shakespearean plays. You know, how do you tell the difference between a tragedy and a comedy? It's not always because you've noticed the gags along the way. Did you notice the gags along the way? My English teacher at high school had to teach me where the gags were. She would say, you know, Hamlet at this point is making a joke. And my reaction would be, oh, just write it down in my exercise book. Hamlet is making a joke, apparently. And you put that in your exam and you pass. So, you know, but Hamlet can tell jokes, but it's a tragedy. Because at the end of Hamlet, what do you have? You have all the actors on the stage just, you know, they're all dead. I mean, the death count is immense. And I'm there in the audience trying to see the actors are still breathing. They're still, I saw him breathing, but still. When the stage is full of the dead, when you end on a funeral, that's a tragedy. But how do Shakespearean comedies end? What's the classical comedy ending for Shakespearean comedy? Wedding. That's right. It's a wedding. Sometimes one wedding or two or four weddings. The classical happily ever after is when the guy and the girl finally get together and you realize that it's a comedy. So let me ask you a question this evening. What do you think life is? Is life a tragedy or is it a comedy?
Yes.
It's a yes. It's a tragicomedy. Okay, it's a tragic comedy. Well, think about how your life ends. Does it end with a funeral or a wedding? Oh. Ends with a funeral, doesn't it? So if Shakespeare was to write the story of your life, it would be a tragedy, wouldn't it? And how do we tend to live lives? We tend to live lives as though we need to grab and climb and scratch and take and get and be on top. And we enjoy our brief moment in the sun, but then we're over the hill, and then we tumble down into the grave. That's the shape of my life. That's the shape of your life. That's the shape of all natural life. It's a frowny face. It's a tragedy, isn't it? Life is a tragedy. Thanks very much for coming tonight, and we hope to see you tomorrow. But it's true that life is utterly tragic. And there's an old quote. They say the difference between tragedy and comedy is when the curtain falls. You see, the curtain might fall at the end of a death scene, and you think, oh, well, that's a tragedy. But what if the curtain stays up? And what if somehow the hero rises up again from the dead? What would you have then? Then you'd have a comedy. And this is really what John's Gospel is telling you. Here is this story in which Jesus comes to planet Earth, and he starts on high. On Tuesday, we had a look at the beginning of John's Gospel. Jesus begins before the beginning of the world. There he is with his Father and the Holy Spirit. God is light and life and love. Everything's going well. And then the world comes. And what happens with the world? The world turns from light. And when you turn from light, you have darkness. The world turns from love. And when you turn from love, you get disconnection. The world turns from life and you get death. Darkness, death, disconnection. That's the pit that you and I find ourselves in. So what shape are we making? We're starting on high. There's this turn from the light into the darkness. But then Jesus comes and he meets us, as we said on Thursday night. He meets us in the valley of the shadow of death. He meets us in this place. And he even takes that darkness and that death and that disconnection on himself on the cross. That's good news, isn't it? You are loved at your weakest. You are loved at your worst. Because here comes Jesus down into our pit, and he shoulders our burden. That's wonderful. But if the curtain fell then, what would you call this book? You'd call it a tragedy, because it ends in a funeral. But what if you come to page 52? Well, here is a possibility that there is a happily ever after. And it's not just a happily ever after for Jesus. If this is true, this can be a happily ever after for you. Because if Jesus has beaten death, he can get you through death. And you can end on a high too. But let's have a look at the big number 21. Means it's John chapter 21. And we'll see this scene. It is both funny, in that funny things happen, and it's comedic, in that there's a great turn of events and death is defeated. So here we go. Jesus and the miraculous catch of fish. Jesus has already risen from the dead. He's already appeared to the disciples. But here's another appearance. Afterwards, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them. And they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat. But that night they caught nothing. You know, every time Simon goes fishing without Jesus, he catches nothing. Like, all the time. You wonder why he's turning back to fishing at this point. It's all he knows. He's a rubbish fisherman now. And he's miserable, isn't he? Well, I'm going out to fish. But he's quite the leader, and others come and join him. Verse 4, early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He's pranking them, okay? He's totally pranking them. And what does he do? Here come the sharp words. He called out to them. Do you ever do this to fishermen? Friends, have you caught anything? He knows they haven't. He's ribbing them. Friends, haven't you any fish? No, they answered. He said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. Now, why on earth they obey this stranger on the shore? Somehow there's this voice that's coming that has authority. And for some reason, here are hardened fishermen, that's all they've known, and this stranger on the shore says, just put your nets on the other side of the boat. Like, ordinarily, you say, sod off. But somehow, this voice carries authority. So they put the nets on the other side, and when they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Slowly, the penny is dropping, verse 7. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved, John, said to Peter, it's the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it's the Lord, I love this, he wrapped his outer garment round him, for he'd taken it off, and jumped into the water. Yeah, exactly. Ridiculous, isn't it? It's ridiculous. Peter hears that it's Jesus, and he has two separate thoughts that individually make sense. Okay, one thought is, oh, it's Jesus, I better get dressed. The other thought is, oh, it's Jesus, I better jump in the water, right? Now, individually, those two ideas make a lot of sense. Put together, it's just ridiculous. So he becomes fully clothed and then jumps into the water. The other disciple followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from the shore, about 100 meters. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish already on it and some bread. Jesus has been trolling them.
haven't you any fish? I'm like, oh, I have. Where has Jesus got his fish from? I don't know. Where did he get them from? I don't know. But then, Jesus says, verse 10, then Jesus said, bring some of the fish you've just caught. So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat. And I just imagine him as Basil Fawlty at this point. He's put his cloak on, he's dived into the water, he's swum to see Jesus. And Jesus says, the fish? So I told you how to catch them. And you can just imagine Simon Peter, right, yes, right, sorry. Goes back, drags the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. None of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. Don't you love that line, verse 12? Come and have breakfast. Come and have breakfast. We've just enjoyed a wonderful barbecue together. Don't you love that when Jesus went through death and came out the other side, he showed us these snapshots of the future? That's why we're given these scenes. Once Jesus rises from the dead, we're getting these snapshots of the future. What does it look like when death is behind us and we are in the presence of Jesus? What does it look like? You read to the end of all these Gospels, all these biographies of Jesus, and you know what happens? Jesus goes for long country walks with friends. He talks with them long into the night about the stuff that really matters. He has endless meals with people. There are tear-filled reunions. There's fishing with mates. There's barbecues on the beach. That's the life, isn't it? That's eternal life, according to the Bible, according to Jesus. According to Jesus, someone has come into our pit and punched a hole through death and come out the other side. And he says, come with me. Come walk my way. And with me, you have fishing with friends, barbecues on the beach, long country walks, discussions late into the night, tear-filled reunions, and Jesus face to face. That's the future according to Jesus. That's pretty good, don't you think? That is the happily ever after that Jesus pioneers. Now, without Jesus, you know what you have? You just have tragic living. Without Jesus, all you do is climb, grab, scratch, take, get on top. Because you know that the clock is ticking and soon you'll be tumbling down into that grave. That's the only way you can live, is the tragic life. And some of us are very overt in the way that we grab and scratch and take. And some of us, it's just more quiet in our hearts. Peter, interestingly, throughout John's gospel, he's lived quite a tragic life throughout this. He's been such a proud person. Throughout John's gospel, he's been the sort of person who, the night before Jesus dies, he says, even if everyone else falls away from you, Jesus, I never will. I'm iron. And a ridiculous figure that Peter is, within a matter of hours, he is denying that he ever knew Jesus, denying it to the servant girl, failing. He climbs up in the world, and he ends up falling flat on his face. Interestingly, he fell flat on his face and denied Jesus around a campfire. And here Jesus is, he's arranging for a different kind of campfire. And he says to Peter, who's lived this ridiculous, tragic life of climbing up in the world, and trying to make it himself, and falling flat on his face, he invites Peter to come around that campfire. And from verse 15, he asks Peter, do you love me? Three times. Around the other campfire, Peter had denied Jesus three times. And Jesus gives him an opportunity, do you love me three times? And now around this second campfire, Peter is restored. He's brought into the comedy. He's reconciled to Jesus. He's forgiven and set back on his feet. And away Peter goes to lead the church. But that's the journey that all of us are invited to make. All of us in this room naturally live the tragic life. All of us climb up in the world and then fall flat on our faces. And sometimes that's a bit funny, isn't it? You know, think of David Brent or someone, you know, the proud person who is then brought low. Think of the pompous person slipping on the banana peel, right? Ha! It's funny, but it's tragic. That's the shape of the tragic life, and that's the natural shape of my life. Naturally, I just want to live the selfish life, build my own empire, and then it all comes crumbling, crumbling down. Jesus says, renounce the tragedy and embrace the comedy. Do you know what that would mean? It would actually mean coming to Jesus and saying, Jesus, I'm ridiculous. I'm sorry. I am ridiculous. I build and scratch and climb and take and try to get on top. And I'm so sorry for this tragic way of life. It's dishonored you and it's hurt other people. I'm really sorry for that. I want to renounce the tragedy. I want to embrace the comedy. What does embracing the comedy mean? Well, it means embracing Jesus. Saying, Jesus, I see that you are the one who has the power over death. You are the one who's defeated the great enemy that defeats everybody else. You must be Lord. Death defeats everybody else. Jesus defeats death. What do you call Jesus? Jesus is Lord. He's master. And maybe you see Jesus as Lord. Maybe you see Jesus as master. Maybe for the first time, as you come to him, you need to renounce the tragedy and embrace his comedy. What does that mean, embracing his comedy? Does that mean that life will now become a laugh a minute? Will your hands and thighs now become leathery from being slapped together so much? Is that what's... No. Embracing the comedy means going down into service and suffering and sacrifice for the sake of others, just as Jesus did it. You don't do any of that stuff to earn God's love. You've got God's love. He's loved you at your worst. He's loved you while you're in a pit. But now that he's picked you up, he says, come on, I'll show you the comedic way to live. The comedic way to live is to pour yourself out, to go down into suffering and service and sacrifice for the sake of others. But then at the end, to be raised up to the happily ever after. And what is that happily ever after? It's long country walks, discussions late into the night with friends, reunions, fishing with friends, barbecues on the beach. That's the life. That's the life Jesus invites you into. Is that something you want? You know, without Jesus, there is no hope. That sounds like a very cutting thing to say, isn't it? Only Jesus gives you hope in this world. Only Jesus. But it's actually just true. You go to any worldview, any religion, and you ask anyone, is there any hope for these bodies in this world? You can go to religions, you can go to philosophies, you can go to self-help gurus, you can ask, is there any hope for these bodies in this world? And you'll go to all the religions and all the philosophies in the world, and they'll all say, no, yes. Who are you? I am Jesus. He is the one man who has pioneered a pathway through death and out into immortal, deathless, feasting joy. There is no hope apart from Jesus. None of us have any hope apart from Jesus. But he is offered to each one of us. So do you want him? Do you want to renounce that tragedy and embrace his comedy? If you do, I'm just going to, in a second, I'll offer some words that you might want to pray to say to Jesus. Jesus, I'm sorry, I'm ridiculous. Sorry for being selfish. Sorry for turning from you. But thank you for joining me in the pit. Thank you for taking my darkness on the cross. Thank you for rising again to give me hope. I embrace you and I embrace your comedy. If that's something you feel that you can pray tonight, why don't you echo these words in your heart? Should we bow our heads and let me pray for us? And this might be one way of starting a journey with Jesus. You can echo these words in your heart if they're true for you. Dear Jesus, I'm sorry for living such a ridiculous life at times. I'm sorry for thinking that I'm in charge. How silly. I'm sorry for grasping and climbing and taking and being selfish. Please forgive me. Jesus, thank you for dying for me on that cross to take away all my sin. And thank you for rising again to give me eternal hope. Jesus, come into my life. Lead me. and lead me in your comedy, in a life of service and sacrifice for others. Walk with me through this valley, Lord Jesus, and out to your feasting joy. Amen. Once again, if you have prayed that kind of prayer, do make yourself known to us. There are all sorts of ways that you can do that on the card, but also do just say hello to the person who brought you and maybe just confess to them. Yeah, I've wanted to make a start in following Jesus, because you're going to need help, and we're here to help you. So thanks so much for listening so well. I'm going to hand back to Kev, and he's going to wrap things up for us tonight. Thanks, Kev.